something else. And I say it deliberately.
Keep it simple, Helen.
Jimmy Nightingale is involved in this.
That's not what the evidence indicates.
Maybe he didn't rape Rowena Broussard, but I think he knew Kevin Penny did. Maybe he even sicked him on her.
We'll never prove that, Helen. Let it go.
I saw him at the Winn-Dixie yesterday. People were lining up to shake his hand. He put his arm over my shoulders. I felt like I'd been molested.
I had never heard her talk like this. You think he's the third Antichrist in Nostradamus?
No. I think he's Huey Long on a national scale. And that scares the shit out of me. That night, I drifted off to sleep while watching the local news. When I woke, I realized I was listening to the voice of Jimmy Nightingale. He was confessing to the satchel bombing of the Indian village in South America. There were tears in his eyes. He could have been a character actor in a medieval everyman play. Out on the salt, he had told me the same story. I believed then, and I believe now, that he was at least partially contrite. But the man I saw on television that night was a man who could sell snow to Eskimos and electric blankets to the damned. I drove to Barron's Health Club in New Iberia at 5:30 the next morning and went to work on the speed bag.
"I'm glad that's not my face you're hitting," a voice behind me said.
I turned around.
"Visiting with the lumpin' proletariat?"
"I'll buy you breakfast at Victor's," Jimmy said.
"Forget it.
What I do now?"
"I caught your performance on the news last night."
"Performance?" I let my hands hang at my sides, my bag gloves tight on my knuckles, the blood hammering in my wrists. I could smell my own odor.
"You and I talked about that situation in South America. I thought you were genuinely sorry for the bad choice you made."
"I like that terminology."
"Yeah. Bad choice. It's the kind of crap you hear in Hollywood."
I didn't finish. "I think you're using the suffering of the people you maimed and killed to further your career. That takes a special kind of guy."
"That's pretty strong, Dave."
He rested one hand on my shoulder even though my t-shirt was gray with sweat. "I don't like people touching me." He lowered his hand.
"Take a shower. We'll eat breakfast and talk. I always looked up to you. You know that."
"I have to go to work." A kid was hitting a heavy bag, hard enough to make it jump on the chain.
"Can you give us a minute?" Jimmy said.
"Sure," the kid replied awkwardly, as though he had done something wrong.
"Hang on, partner," I said. "Mr. Jimmy and I are going outside."
"I got to get to class at UL," the kid said. "It's all right." After we were alone, Jimmy said,
"You look like you want to drop me."
"You know the chief sign of narcissism, don't you? Entitlement. That's another word for self-important jerk."
"I want to offer you a job. Maybe Purcell, too."
"Doing security?"
"That's part of it."
"What's the other part?"
"Arguing with me and telling me when I'm wrong. You know what LBJ said to Eric Severide when the two of them were watching Nixon's inauguration on the tube?"
"No."
"He's made a mistake. He's taken amateurs with him. I don't want amateurs on my team."
"I'll start now, free of charge. Stop lying."
"Liars own up on television to murdering defenseless Indians?"
"Hump your own pack, Jimmy. How'd you know where I was?"
"Your daughter was up. She's back on the set, huh?"
"What about it?"
"I wish I was on it," he said.
"Hollywood is a magical place.
I don't care what people say about it."
"Don't tell that to your constituency," I said.
"You think they don't like movies? Who do you think has filled the theaters for the last 116 years?
He clenched his hand on the back of my neck, his fingers sinking into the flesh, fusing with the oil and sweat running out of my hair, his eyes next to mine, his breath on my skin. One of his feet stepped on top of mine. "Work with me. You can have power. You never guessed it. We'll turn the world. into the Garden of Eden. As he walked away, I picked up a towel and wiped my face and neck and arms and hands, trying to cleanse his touch and the wetness of his mouth from my body and mind. Chapter 35. All day I was troubled by thoughts about Jimmy Nightingale and LaVon Broussard and the way Kevin Penny and Tony Nineball and Spade LaBiche had gone out. I have always believed there's no mystery to human behavior. We're the sum total of our deeds. But that wasn't the way things had been working out. I was fairly certain LaBiche had been on a pad for Tony and was told to set up a situation with T.J. D'Artes that would put me either in prison or on the injection table. Other than that, I had no idea who'd killed Penny or who was pulling the strings on the surreal hitman known only as Smiley. At the center of it all were Jimmy Nightingale and his foil, LaVon Broussard. I suspected an analyst would say both of them had borderline personality disorder. Or maybe a dissociative personality disorder. Unfortunately, those terms would apply to most drunks, addicts, fiction writers, and actors. Both men descended from prominent families in a state where Shintoism in its most totalitarian form was not only a given, but most obvious in its sad influence on the poor and uneducated, who accepted their self-abasing roles with the humility of serfs. But there was an existential difference between the two families. For the Nightingales, manners and morality were interchangeable. For LaVon Broussard and his ancestors, honor was a religion, more pagan than Christian in concept, the kind of mindset associated with a Templar knight or pilots in the Japanese Air Force. For the Broussards, honor was a virtue that once tarnished could never be restored. They may have been aristocrats and slave owners who lived inside a fable, but they still heard the horns blowing along the road to Roncesvalles and accepted genteel poverty and isolation if necessary, but would be no more capable of changing their vision of the world and themselves than Robert E. Lee could have become a used car salesman. That was why I had a hard time believing that LaVon could have tortured and murdered Kevin Penny. I had even greater difficulty believing he would throw in his lot with Tony Nimo in order to weigh the balance in his upcoming trial in Jefferson Davis Parish. On Monday morning, I got a call at my office from Sherry Picard. "I need your help," she said. "What can I do for you?" I asked, trying to suppress my feelings about Cleet's involvement with younger women in general, and this one in particular.
"Catch you at the wrong time?"
"Not at all. I still have prints from the Penny homicide scene that I believe are significant.
The fast food trash. Penny kept the area around his motorcycle clean. That means the person who left it there was on the property the day Penny died."
"What does this have to do with me?" I said.
"I want to fingerprint the Nightingale employees. I'm not getting anywhere."
"St. Mary Parish was teleported from the 14th century. Historians come from far away to study it."
"Did I do something to offend you?"
"I can't help you in St. Mary."
"How about with LaVon Broussard?"
"What about him?"
"I want to fingerprint his wife. I think she may have been an accomplice."
"I'm not convinced LaVon is guilty, much less his wife." I could feel her resentment coming through the phone. I tried again. "What makes you suspicious about his wife?"
"Her general attitude. I think she needs a flashlight shined up her ass."
"How about that?"
"Did you hear me?" she said.
"Absolutely."
"Absolutely what?"
"That I heard you," I said.
"What's your problem?"
"I don't have one."
"Are you pissed off because of Cleet and me?"
"I don't know what you're talking about."
"We called it off. That's why you've got your tallywhacker and the hay baler?"
"I'll talk with LaVon, Ms. Picard."
"Detective Picard."
I softly replaced the receiver in the cradle. The phone rang 3 minutes later. I thought she was calling back,
I felt embarrassed as I picked up the receiver and wished I hadn't hung up on her. Surprise time.
"I heard you used to live in New Orleans," a voice said. "You were a police officer in the quarter."
I sat up in my chair. "That's right.
I had an artist friend who knew you. He painted people's pictures in Jackson Square. He said you were an honest police officer."
I waved my arm at a cop in uniform passing in the hallway. He looked through the glass. I pointed at the receiver. He nodded and disappeared down the hallway. "What's your name?" I said. "I'll help you if I can."
"I think you know who I am."
"Not for sure. Are you visiting in New Iberia?"
"Some people call me Smiley."
"That doesn't ring bells."
"I want to ask you a question."
"Yes, sir. Go right ahead." Helen was at the glass in my door now. I mouthed the word, "Smiley."
"Does the man named Purcell have a boy?"
"You mean Cleet Purcell?"
"A boy lives with him," he said.
"Cleet doesn't have a birth son, but he takes care of an orphan. Is that the boy you're talking about?" He cleared his throat but didn't speak. "You there, Smiley?"
"Yes."
"Did you want to tell me something?"
"What's the boy's name?"
"Homer."
"What's the rest of it?"
"Homer Penny is his full name." I waited in the silence. I had given up information I normally wouldn't, but this situation was outside the parameters of any in my career. "Did you try to hurt Cleet, Smiley?"
"This call is a relay. It won't help you to twice it."
I figured. "That means we can talk as long as you want. Where'd you get your nickname?" No answer. "Know who your accent reminds me of?" I said. "Tennessee Williams. He said New Orleans, just like you. I knew him when he lived in the quarter." I could hear him breathing against the mouthpiece as though deciding whether or not to hang up.
"I don't care about him."
"Have you been to Algiers?" I said. "A couple of bad black dudes got their grit splattered over there."
"What do you know about it?"
"Between you and me, I think they probably had it coming. You hear anything about that?"
"They were bad to a colored lady.
Poor name, with Miss Buddy. Did you smoke these dudes?"
"Maybe," he said. "If you are bad or treacherous with me, I'll smoke you too."
"I believe you, but I'd rather be friends with you."
"I wouldn't hurt a child," he said, his voice downshifting.
"I know what you mean. There's nothing worse than the abuse of children or animals. That's why Cleet takes care of Homer. Cleet had a hard upbringing."
"I'm sorry. Tell him that."
"Tell Cleet?"
"Yes. I didn't know about the boy."
"I read you loud and clear, partner. I know anything about Kevin Penny, Smiley?"
"He was a bad man."
"You didn't help him do the big exit, did you?"
"You're trying to trick me."
"Not me. I'm not that smart. You're like a shadow. You come and go, and nobody has a clue. Who was your artist friend?"
"He was my friend for a while. Then he wasn't my friend anymore."
"Could we work out a way to communicate when both of us have more time? I'm pretty tied up right now."
"I can come by your house."
He had me. I could almost see him grinning. "You're calling the shots. Did you ever hear Louis Prima and Sam Butera play at the Dream Room on Bourbon?"
"You want to know how old I am? Remember 15 years ago when a house was torn down on Calliope and a body fell out of the wall? It had been in there long enough not to smell anymore. This man was bad to somebody who trusted him and got walled up with his paintbrushes stuffed in his mouth. He was a very bad boy. Bye-bye."
The line went dead. I looked blankly at Helen through the glass. I had witnessed 2 deaths by electrocution in the Red Hat House at Angola. On both occasions,
I'd felt that I was watching an element in the human gene pool for which there was no remedy. And I mean the desire to kill, either on the part of individuals or the state. I took a Kleenex from a drawer in my desk and cleared my throat and spat in it, then dropped it into the waste can. At noon, I took Cleet to lunch at Bon Creole out on East St. Peter Street. We ordered fried oyster poor boys and sat at a table under a blue and silver marlin mounted on the wall. "You couldn't make the trace," he said. "The signal was probably relayed off two or three towers," I said. "You checked out the story about the artist in the wall?" "His name was Pierre Louvier. Evidently he was an eccentric guy who hung out with a weird crowd in the quarter."
"How did he go out?"
"Not easy."
"You think Smiley did, Penny?"
"No."
"Why not?"
"He would have said so. He doesn't have any guilt about the people he kills."
"Psychopaths lie for the sake of lying," Cleet said.
"He was obviously bothered about putting a bomb in a car that would kill a child." The waitress put our food on the table. She looked uncomfortable, obviously having overheard our conversation. "Don't pay attention to us," I said. She tried to smile, but had a hard time with it. She walked away blinking.
"Go on," Cleet said to me.
"I think Smiley feels he got set up."
"No idea who he's working for?"
"None." "Sherry Picard called." Cleet looked at a place 6 inches from the side of my face.
"Yeah?"
"She said y'all aren't hanging out anymore."
"It's more like she flushed me. No big deal."
"Right." I avoided looking at his eyes. He put a cracker into his mouth and chewed. He hadn't touched his sandwich. "She's off the wall, Cleet."
"I'm old, she's young, you warned me, end of subject."
"Age is not a factor. She has the grace of a chainsaw." "Wrong choice." 3 things about Cleet Purcell. Since I'd first met him, he'd never once used God's name in vain, referred to a woman in a profane way, or criticized a woman who dumped him. Unless you counted the postcard he sent me from El Sal, when he skipped the country on a murder beef and asked me to tell his ex, who cheated on him, that he wanted her to have the toothbrush he'd left in the bathroom. He wadded up a napkin and lobbed it into a trash can by the cold drink dispenser.
"Smiley say anything about Jimmy Nightingale?"
"No, but I had a strange experience with Jimmy at Barron's Health Club."
"Like what?"
"I was hitting the speed bag and pretty sweaty and dirty. He squeezed the back of my neck and whispered in my ear. He was standing on my foot." Cleet's gaze went away from mine, then came back.
"He's AC/DC?
"He was talking about making the world into the Garden of Eden."
"You're making this up?"
"Jimmy isn't the same guy I used to know," I said. "But that's not what bothers me. I couldn't scrub his touch off my skin." "Helen said the same thing about him." Cleet looked into space.
"I think I'm going back to the Big Sleazy for a few days. Start putting junk in my arm, hanging out at bottomless clubs, go to a Crisco party at a steam room, do something healthy for a change."
"It's not funny, Cleet."
"None of this is," he replied. "I didn't give you the whole gin on Sherry. She called one of her sniper targets a sand nigger. She tried to take it back, but it made me think about her relationship to Kevin Penny."
"She might have decided to get rough."
"Sherry wouldn't make a good Mary Knoll."
Cleet went to Walmart that afternoon. On the way out, he ran into Swede Jensen, the Nightingale chauffeur, whom he'd helped get a job as an extra in Levon's film adaptation. Swede was wearing white Bermuda shorts with bananas on them and a sleeveless golf shirt, his tan as dark as saddle leather, his armpit hair stiff and bleached by the sun. His concave face always reminded Cleet of a hominid replica he had seen in a natural history museum.
"What's the hap, Swede?" Cleet said.
Swede looked around but kept walking.
"Wait up," Cleet said.
"Oh, hey, what say, Purcell?"
Swede replied, studying his watch.
"How's it hanging?"
"I saw you on the set behind Albania Plantation. You were wearing a Confederate uniform."
"Yeah, it's a lot of fun."
"They paying you okay?"
Yeah, union scale, all that stuff.
Cleet waited for Swede to thank him. It didn't happen.
You don't have a conflict with your chauffeur job?
The Nightingales are flexible. Sorry, I got the boogie.
Yeah, the sky's about to fall. Look at me.
Like I said, Swede began.
No, you didn't say anything. Your eyes are going everywhere except my face. In the meantime, you're blowing me off. It's called rude.
Thanks for what you did. I got a ton of things to do. Nice seeing you.
Cleet stepped in his way.
Don't talk shit to me, Swede.
Swede looked like an animal with a limb caught in a trap.
Did you know fear smells like soiled cat litter? Cleet said.
Swede almost ran through the door.
That weekend, southern Louisiana was sweltering, thunder cracking as loud as cannons in the night sky. At sunrise, the storm drains clogged with dead beetles that had shells as hard as pecans. It was the kind of weather we associated with hurricanes and tidal surges and winds that rip tin roofs off houses and bounce them across sugarcane fields like crushed beer cans. It was the kind of weather that gave the lie to the sleepy southern culture whose normalcy we so fiercely nursed and protected from generation to generation. I could not sleep Sunday night, and on Monday I woke with a taste like pennies in my mouth, and a sense that my life was unspooling before me, that the world in which I lived was a fabrication, that the charity abiding in the human breast was a collective self-delusion, and that the bestial elements we supposedly exorcised from civilized society were not only still with us, but had come to define us, although we sanitized them as drones and offshore missiles marked occupant, and landmines that killed children decades after they were set. These are signs of clinical depression, or maybe a realistic vision of the era in which we live. During moments like these, no matter the time of day or night, I had found release only in a saloon. The long bar and brass footrail, the wood-bladed fans, the jars of cracklings and pickled eggs and sausages, the coldness of bottled beer or ice-sheathed mugs, the wink in the barmaid's eye, and the shine on the tops of her breasts, the tumblers of whiskey that glowed with an amber radiance that seemed almost ethereal, the spectral bartender without a last name, the ringing of the pinball machine. All these things became my cathedral, a home beneath the sea, and just as deadly. Thoughts like these are probably a form of alcoholic insanity. But on that particular Monday morning, I preferred my own madness to what I had begun to feel as Helen and Cleet did, namely, that an inchoate sickness was in our midst, and it was as palpable in the hot wetness of the dawn as the smell of lions in the street at high noon. At 9:33 a.m., I received another call from Sherry Picard. I need to talk to you, Cleet, she said. Since he's not in his office and not answering his cell phone, I called you. Thanks, I replied. I was warned about you, too. This is a business line, I said. If you have a personal issue, call me at home. My ass. Did you try to dime me with the FBI?
That's probably one of the craziest things I've heard in a while.
Because an agent just left my office. I have the distinct feeling that I'm being looked at for the Penny homicide.
Talk to the U.S. Justice Department, I said.
The feds hate Cleet's guts.
I don't have contact with them. Most of them wouldn't take the time to spit on us.
Don't give me that. They're in contact with your boss, which means they're in contact with you.
Why would either Cleet or I dime you, detective? I said.
Because I told him we're not right for each other?
It was fun and now we move on?
It was nothing personal. I thought he was a sweet guy.
Rejection is not personal. That's wonderful.
You'd better stay out of my life and my career, she said.
Be assured I will.
I have a second reason for calling. Levon Broussard just came into the prosecutor's office and confess to torturing Penny to death. What do you think of that, Slick?
Chapter 36. That was not all Levon did. After confessing to an ADA in the Jeff Davis courthouse, he went out the side door, drove to a low-bottom joint north of Four Corners in Lafayette, got plowed out of his head, and at sunset drove across his lawn to the gallery on the front of his house and announced to his wife, "Hi, honey, I'm home."
Helen called me on my cell.
"Get over to Levon Broussard's place. It looks like he's lost it."
"What's he doing?"
"Who knows? His wife called in the 911. He's in the yard with a Confederate flag and a sword, ranting at the sky. He fired a flare pistol across the bayou and asked some people in a boat to come in for a drink. I think they're still emptying out their shoes."
I drove to his house.
The sky was a red and black ink wash, the oaks he had named for Confederate officers chattering with birds. A patrol car was parked in the neighbor's drive. Another was parked by the tennis courts across the two-lane highway. I got out of my pickup and walked around the side of the house and threw a line of camellia bushes into the backyard. He was sitting at a folding table under a huge oak by the bayou, the faded battle flag he had kept encased in glass hanging from an overhead branch. It looked like cheesecloth against the sunset. The dried blood of the drummer boy reminded me of the coppery stains on the shroud of Turin. Levon lifted a bottle of cold duck above his head.
"Welcome to Chaucer's blue-collar good night. Or is it every man I see? Wrong evening for bromides, Davy."
His face was oily and dissolute with booze. He had stabbed his great-grandfather's sword into the side by his foot. His teeth were stained with wine.
"Looks like you've had quite a day," I said.
"How's that, Davy?"
"Confessing to an ADA in Jennings, scaring your friends in New Iberia?"
"Not so about scaring my friends."
I nodded at the flag lifting in the breeze above us.
"That should be in a controlled environment, shouldn't it? Protected from dust and humidity."
"It survived Yankee artillery at Owl Creek. That's where the 18th Louisiana got torn to pieces. In 15 minutes, 40% were casualties."
"You can't win on yesterday's box score. Why lose because of it?"
"That one zipped by me."
"The past has no reality. The world belongs to the living."
"You know better. You see them in the mists out at Spanish Lake."
"See whom?"
"I love you for your diction, if nothing else. The boys in Butternut."
"You see them slogging through the cypresses."
"Who told you that?"
"They did," he replied.
I wanted to believe he was mad. Unfortunately, I no longer knew what madness was.
"Why did you confess to a crime you didn't commit?" I asked.
"You don't believe me capable of killing the man who raped my wife?"
"You didn't try to kill the black guys who raped her in Wichita?"
"I'm making up for lost time."
"Not with toggle bolts and an electric drill."
"I thought that was an inventive touch."
"Quit lying, Levon." I pulled the sword from the ground and stuck the brass guard in his face. "Look at the names on there. Cemetery Hill, Sharpsburg, Gaines Mill, Chancellorsville. With a soldier who was at these places, torture a man to death? Even a piece of shit like Kevin Penny?"
"No, he would not. But that doesn't mean I wouldn't."
"Good show. No cigar," I said. "Let's go." I placed my hand lightly on his upper arm. He shook his head and sucked in his cheeks.
"Don't underestimate the situation, Davy."
"Call me Davy again and I'll break your jaw."
He grinned up at me.
"You're a good guy. Butt out of this. Let others do their job."
"You want one of our guys to cap you because you can't do it yourself?"
"Maybe."
"Get a card in the Screen Actors Guild. Come on, I'll take you down to City Hall. Your lawyer will work out something. Helen isn't going to let the guys in Jeff Davis cannibalize you."
I heard the French doors open on the back porch, which was built of brick, high off the ground and hung with ceiling fans. Leave him alone, Rowena said. It doesn't work that way, I said.
He's sick,
she said. He doesn't know what he's saying. I looked at her hands. They were empty. I walked toward her. Don't be a problem for me, Miss Rowena. Go back inside. We'll take good care of him. You have my word.
He's innocent.
I believe that. So leave him here. Talk to him when he's sober. There's a bigger question we need to deal with. Why is he confessing to a crime he's not capable of committing? There was a shine in her eyes. I looked at her a long time. The question stands, Miss Rowena.
I'll bring him to City Hall with our attorney in the morning.
You can bring yourself, but he's going to jail right now.
Hold up there, Dave,
Levon said behind me.
No need for this.
He lifted the flag off the tree with the tip of his great-grandfather's sword.
Let me put this away, and we'll be toggling off, he said.
I looked back at Rowena. For the first time in the case involving the Jeff Davis 8 and Tony Nineball and Jimmy Nightingale and Levon Broussard and Kevin Penny, I knew what had happened. Cleet Purcell believed in straight lines. Bust 'em or dust 'em was his mantra. But there was a caveat. Cleet was never what the mob called a cowboy. He could be a violent man, but with few exceptions, his violence was committed in defense of others. Consequently, his greatest virtue became his greatest vulnerability, and his enemies knew it. He told me about his encounter with Swede Jensen at Walmart and about Jensen's guilt and fear, or at least Cleet's perception of it. Then Cleet stopped answering my calls. I should have known what was coming next. Cleet kept a custom-made extra-long footlocker in the garret above his office. In it were a cut-down Mossberg semi-auto 12-gauge he'd taken off a hitman in Las Vegas, a Glock, two Berettas, a .44 Magnum, a Derringer a deranged prostitute had pulled on him during a vice raid, a sap and a blackjack and a baton, a Slim Jim, brass knuckles, a gun that fired a beanbag, mace, a tear gas pen, a carton of flash grenades, handcuffs, wrist and waist chains, and the most unusual drop I'd ever seen. An engraved snub-nose gold over silver Colt Police 32 with ivory grips that only a collector or a rich man would own. The drop came from the safe of a mobster who operated a lodge and casino above Lake Tahoe. Because the gun was a collectible, its serial numbers, all of them intact, were obviously registered, and the discovery of the pistol at a crime scene would lead the authorities back to the mobster, long dead, and more important, to the casino culture he represented. Tuesday afternoon, Cleet showered and shaved and put on fresh sport clothes and had his hair cut and drove to the Nightingale plantation outside Franklin. He carried the drop in an ankle holster and a scoped 1903 Springfield rifle in the trunk. The azaleas were still in bloom when he turned into the driveway. The St. Augustine grass a deep blue-green, the 4 o'clocks open in the shade of the oak trees. He could feel a surge of adrenaline come alive in his chest and wrists and hands, not unlike the high of going up the Mekong in a swift boat behind twin 50 calibers, the stern dipping and swaying in the trough. He didn't get far. Security came out of the carriage house from the patio and a state police car and a parked SUV with tinted windows. The men in suits were wearing shades. As Cleet slowed the caddy, he unstrapped the ankle holster and let it fall to the floor, then braked and lowered the window. A close-cropped man wearing shades stared into his face.
This is a security area.
Y'all got the nuclear codes inside, Cleet said, the corners of his eyes crinkling.
Is there someone in particular you're looking for?
Jimmy Nightingale. I'm Cleet Purcell. I'm a PI out of New Orleans and New Iberia.
I'm afraid you're not on our visitors list for today.
How about telling Mr. Nightingale I'm here, and then we'll take it from there?
The man at Cleet's window looked over his shoulder.
You can turn your vehicle around in front of the house.
Then get back on the road, please.
That doesn't sound too cool, Cleet said.
Is that a firearm inside your jacket?
I'm licensed to carry.
You need to leave, sir.
No, I don't.
Step out of your vehicle, please.
With the back of his foot, Cleet pushed the drop under the seat. I'm at your service.
He got out of the caddy and lifted his hands and smiled. He towered over most of the security personnel.
What's next?
I'm going to reach inside your jacket for your piece, the man in the suit said. Are you comfortable with that?
As long as you give it back.
The man in shades removed the snub nose from Cleet's shoulder holster and handed it to a St. Mary's Parish Sheriff's deputy. Could I have your keys? Cleet pulled the keys from the ignition and dropped them into the security man's palm. The St. Mary deputy popped the trunk with them. He's got a scoped rifle and an M1 in here.
They're legal, Cleet said. I shoot at a target range. How about giving this stuff a rest?
Stop dancing around with this guy, a voice in the background said. The voice belonged to a tall man wearing western-cut pants and a tight cowboy shirt and mirror-shined, needle-nosed Tony Lamas and a straw cowboy hat with a thin, black, bejeweled band around the crown. His gray mustache was clipped and as stiff as a toothbrush.
Remember me?
No, Cleet said.
Angola, in the 80s. I herded some of the big stripes.
Cleet saw a hazy image in his mind. A gun bull mounted on horseback atop the Mississippi levee, silhouetted against a dull red sun, his expression lost in the shadow of his hat. A sweat-soaked black convict was mule-jerking a stump from the silt, ripping it loose in a shower of dirt.
Wooster, Cleet said.
Good memory.
You shot a kid.
I made a Christian out of a nigger.
You went to work for Tony Squid, Cleet said.
Who? Wooster said.
Is Nightingale here or not? Cleet said.
It's none of your goddamn business. Wooster said.
Cleet blew air out of one nostril and looked sideways.
How y'all think this is going to play out?
With you hauling your ass out of here, Wooster said.
Cleet opened and closed his hands at his sides. They felt stiff and thick, the veins in his forearms cording.
You guys steal the play.
Then Jimmy Nightingale came around the side of the house in tennis clothes, a racket over his shoulder. His skin shiny, not a strand of his bronze-colored hair out of place.
Hey, slow down out there.
We've got it under control, Mr. Nightingale, Wooster said.
Cleet's my friend. What are you doing out here, big fellow?
Long time no see. Not since I ran into you and Bobby Earl at the casino.
How could I forget? You took a drain in poor Bobby's car.
I called you a cunt, and you had me taken out in handcuffs.
We all have our off nights, Nightingale said.
You've got quite a place here.
Why don't you join us out back for a drink?
Cleet wondered how the buried images of the Indians dying in the explosions of the satchel charges did not crack through the perfection of Nightingale's perfect egg-shaped face and leave it like pieces of porcelain at his feet.
Somebody tried to blow up my shit, Cleet said.
I didn't know about that.
If he pulled it off, he would have killed a young boy I take care of. That's a big problem for me.
Let me know if I can help. A little influence never hurts.
The authorities usually see me as the problem. They're often right. See, I'm going to square this on my own.
Give 'em heck, Nightingale said.
I love that kind of language. Give 'em heck. You betcha. It's folksy.
Let me take him out of here, Mr. Nightingale, Wooster said.
I want to be your friend, Cleet,
Nightingale said.
You know that old expression, I don't have an enemy in the world? As long as I'm alive, you'll always have one.
Nightingale laughed.
God, you've got the guts of a beer glass brawl, Purcell.
Come work for me.
I need my piece back.
Give it to him, Nightingale said to the security man.
Mr. Nightingale, I think you should let us handle this.
There will be none of that, Nightingale said. The security man handed Cleet his snub nose. Cleet dropped it into his shoulder holster. A freshly waxed purple Lincoln with chrome-spoked white walls came out of the carriage house with Emmeline Nightingale in the back and Swede Jensen in livery behind the wheel.
"You're behind that geek from Florida, Jimmy," Cleet said.
"Which geek is that?"
"Goes by the tag Smiley. You're dirty. You know it, and I know it, and I'm going to prove it."
"The peace of the Lord be with you."
"Stay indoors during lightning storms," Cleet said. He got into the caddy. Nightingale leaned down to the window.
"I always liked you, Cleet."
"Watch your foot," Cleet said. He backed in a semicircle, breaking the flowers off the camellia bushes, and drove toward the highway, the sunlight splintering in the oak limbs above his head. "How do you get to a guy like Nightingale?" he wondered. "More important, who was he? A master of illusion or a guy with a genius IQ who was brain dead when it came to morality?"
Cleet looked in the rearview mirror. The security men had gone back to their posts, but Nightingale still stood in the middle of the driveway, one hand lifted in farewell, as though he was saying goodbye to a friend from a previous life.
Cleek called me and told me to meet him at Clementine's at 7. "What for?" I said. "I think Nightingale got inside my head."
"Come by the house."
"It might be bugged," he said.
"You've been thinking too much."
"Yeah, I imagine the mercury tilt switch I found by my automobile."
After supper, I walked down to the restaurant. Cleet was at the bar. He knocked back the whiskey in his shot glass and pointed at a table by the brick wall in the back of the dining room. "Where's Homer?" I said.
"Playing softball in the park."
He caught the waiter.
"What are you having, Dave?"
"Nothing." Cleet ordered a plate of etouffee and half a dozen raw oysters and a bottle of Danish beer.
"I'm so dry I'm a fire hazard. Don't get on my case because I've got to have a hit of this or that."
"Lose the mousquetier routine, will you?"
"I got the willies."
He told me what had happened in front of Jimmy Nightingale's home.
"You think he's just an actor? Nothing rattles him. For a minute he made me feel like we were old friends."
"That's Jimmy. He can be humble because he already owns what everyone else wants. What were you doing out there?"
"What I said I was going to do."
Cleet kept his eyes on mine. There was no one within earshot of our table. "You were actually going to bust a cap on him?"
"If I was sure he put the hit on Homer and me."
"In his front yard?"
"I was going to take down the chauffeur, too. I was going to give them a fair chance, then smoke them."
"This is madness, Cleet." The waiter brought the Danish beer. Cleet took a long swig, looking at me with a protruding eye. He set the bottle on the tablecloth.
"Madness is when you let an innocent boy get maimed or blown apart the way Nightingale did those Indians. Don't give me any doodah streak."
"Who'll take care of Homer if you're in Angola?"
"Thanks for the help. You really know how to say it."
"I'll talk to you in the morning," I said. I flicked my fingernail on the neck of the Danish beer. "No more of this tonight." Cleet picked up the bottle and chugged it dry. I got up from the table and squeezed his shoulder, then kept going out the door and down the sidewalk in the summer night, the air heavy with the smell of jasmine, the water high and yellow and coursing with organic debris under the drawbridge. For just a fleeting moment, I wished the year were 1862. Chapter 37. Levon Broussard was transferred from custody in Iberia Parish to Jefferson Davis Parish. I did not believe he was guilty of the Kevin Penny homicide, but nonetheless I was glad he was gone, and I hoped that I would not be entangled with him and his wife for a while. That wasn't the way it worked out. Sherry Picard was in my office Thursday morning. I rose from my chair when she entered, but it was hard. "Good morning," I said. "How are you? What brings you to town?"
"Nice day."
"You speak like you're constipated," she said.
I have a tumor on my vocal cords, I said. It comes and goes. I've never understood it.
What's with Levon Broussard? Why do you think he confessed?
Haven't a clue, I said, my face empty.
Good try.
He's in your jurisdiction, he's your problem.
I thought he was your friend.
Right now I'm worried about Cleet Purcell. He has a terrible character defect. He's a bad judge of people. I saw the color climb in her face.
I want to speak to Sheriff Swallow.
Bang on her door.
Listen.
Then I saw her blink, the breath go out of her throat, a tremble in her chin. I lowered my voice. Look at me, detective.
Look at you, she said.
Sometimes I get my head on sideways. I'm reactive. I don't mean it.
I'm tired of getting fucked over, she said.
I dropped my eyes. It was an unpleasant moment. Her need was obvious. There is no organizational injustice worse than putting a misogynistic cop or military officer in charge of female personnel. The abuse that follows is immediate, egregious, and cruel to the bone. Can I ask you something? I said. I heard that you called one of your targets in Iraq or Afghanistan a sand nigger.
I was mad at Cleet. He kept talking about the Mamasan he killed by accident. I told him to let it go. I was deliberately crude about my own history. You think I'm a racist?
No.
You want to have lunch? She said.
I opened the bottom drawer in my desk and lifted up a brown paper bag that was folded neatly across the top. Inside I kept a spare rain jacket and hood. Brought my own.
I didn't intend to hurt Cleet. He's a good guy.
So are you, I said.
Oh, yeah?
She touched at a mole on her chin and looked at the ball of her finger.
See you around, hotshot. Keep it in your pants.
I watched her walk out the door.
I had a feeling that Sherry Picard cast a large net.
And maybe that was just my imagination.
On a peninsula that extended into the Gulf of Mexico, Chester Wimple followed the Lincoln driven by the chauffeur with peroxided hair that reminded him of popcorn butter.
The wind was blowing hard out of the south, the flags on the boathouses and the elevated camps snapping, waves breaking against the chunks of concrete that had been dumped along the banks to keep the peninsula from eroding away. Chester could see Emmeline in the back seat of the Lincoln, in sunglasses, a scarf on her head. The Lincoln turned into a camp at the end of the peninsula, and Emmeline and the chauffeur went inside laughing.
At what? Had Chester set the bomb in the Cadillac owned by the fat man, he might have killed a child. That was something to laugh at?
No.
Emmeline couldn't hurt a child. Not after what she and Chester had suffered in the orphanage in Mexico City.
Chester parked his rented car on a lot that had been left deserted after Hurricane Rita wiped out the structure and left little except clusters of banana plants and windmill palms and persimmon trees. Because it was a weekday with a forecast of storms and lightning, few of the other camps were occupied. He got out of his car with his binoculars and scope 223 carbine and worked his way along the bank until he had a good view of the Lincoln and the camp to the south, backdropped by waves that were swelling higher and higher. The camp had a rustic exterior, with a peaked metal roof and walls made of heavy dark-stained timbers, but the satellite dishes and the propane crab boiler and barbecue pit on the fantail and the sliding glass and gold trim on the doors hinted of the luxury and level of comfort inside. Chester focused his binoculars through the sliding door on the living room. Emmeline was brushing out her hair in front of a mirror. The chauffeur had put on boxer swim trunks and was sitting in a black leather chair, his legs crossed. A clipboard was propped on his knee. He was writing on an index card. He tilted his head one way, then another. No, he was not writing. He was sketching something on the same kind of cards that told Chester who and where his target was. Chester removed the binoculars from his eyes and watched the seagulls dipping out of the wind into the froth, scooping up tiny fish with their beaks. The sky was gray, the clouds torn in strips like a ruined flag. Out on the horizon, he saw a sailboat trying to tack against the storm, the mast bending into the waves. He sat on a block of concrete that knifed into his buttocks, his fists propped on his thighs, his head bowed. He stared at the camp without aid of the binoculars. The building looked like a harmless photo snipped out of a newspaper, without depth or meaning, glued on cardboard. Then he used the binoculars again and saw the face of the chauffeur in the reflection of a desk lamp. The chauffeur was grinning, perhaps laughing at a joke, perhaps laughing at Chester. Emmeline sat in his lap. Chester pulled back the bolt on the carbine and snapped around into the chamber.
"What you doing, mister?"
a voice said. The flesh jumped off his back. He turned and saw a little black girl no more than 10. She had her pigtails tied on top of her head with a pink ribbon. She wore tennis shoes and floppy shorts and a T-shirt with a laughing octopus on it.
"Hi,"
Chester said, his face like stretched rubber.
"Is that an air gun?"
she asked.
"Yes." "You ain't shooting the gulls, are you?"
"No, I wouldn't do that."
"You just target practicing?"
"Yes.
Who are you?"
"Loretta. My mama worked for the Vadrines up the road there."
"Do they know where you are?"
"My mama do. Ain't nobody else there."
"You should go back home. There's a storm coming."
"Then I'll go inside. What's your name?"
"Smiley."
"Hi, Smiley. Do you know somebody here?"
"I have a friend named Miss Emmeline."
"Look, there's a flying fish," she said. He watched it glide above the waves, its fins extended, its scaled body as sleek as a spear blade. It disappeared, then rose again, defying the laws of nature.
"How come it can fly?" the girl asked.
"It was, probably, born in a place full of sharks. The sharks were eating all the little fish. So a magic lady who lives under the sea gave them wings. From that day on, they sailed above the water and got away from the sharks."
"Where's the magic lady?"
"She's still down there, taking care of little fish that don't have a mommy or a daddy."
"I bet you made that up."
"Not me."
"You're smiling."
"You make me smile," he said.
"What's that can on the end of your gun?"
"It stops the sound, so when I'm target shooting, I don't scare people."
"I got to go now. It was nice to meet you."
"Goodbye, Loretta."
She looked back.
"Don't get caught in the rain, no."
He watched her walk away, then stepped carefully among the chunks of concrete and placed himself on an embankment by a cluster of banana stalks with a clear view of the camp. 15 minutes passed. A line of black clouds veined with lightning had formed on the southern horizon. The chauffeur came out on the deck and propped his arms on the rail, his unbuttoned shirt swelling around him. Chester sighted and pulled the trigger. The chauffeur seemed to stiffen as though someone had touched him unexpectedly between the shoulder blades. A red flower bloomed against his shirt. He turned in a circle, his fingers splayed across his breastbone, and walked with the concentration of a tightrope performer toward the sliding door. Chester picked up the ejected shell and drove to the camp and knocked on the door. The carbine hung from his hand. Emmeline pulled the door open. Her mouth was twitching, her fingers slick with blood that was as thick as paint.
"What have you done?"
"Could I have a sandwich, please? I didn't eat lunch. I need to pee-pee, too."
He walked past her. She was speechless, her eyelids fluttering, as translucent as a moth's wings.
Through a door off the living room, he could see a double bed with a coverlet and pillows and sheets in disarray. The chauffeur was sitting on the rug by the sliding doors, one arm hooked over the end of the couch, breathing through his mouth as though he had run up a hill. Emmeline washed her hands in the kitchen sink, looking over her shoulder. The chauffeur began to moan. "Get the towels out of the bathroom," she said to Chester. "There's a first aid kit in the closet. I have to think."
"I want a snack, Em."
"A snack?"
"My tummy is hurting."
"Why did you shoot Swede?"
she said, her voice pulling loose from her throat.
"Who's Swede?"
"The man you just shot, you stupid shit!"
"I have to talk to you about what I was told to do," Chester said.
"To the man with the convertible." The chauffeur moaned again.
"Shut up,"
Chester said to Swede.
"Chester, please do what I say. Close the curtains. Get some bandages. I didn't mean to call you a bad word. I have to plan for us. I always took care of us, didn't I?"
"Did you know about the boy who lives with the fat man in the motor court?"
"What boy? What are you talking about?"
"The man named Purcell. He has a little boy living with him."
"I don't know anything about that."
"Get the kit out of the bathroom. I'll have to call 911,
and you'll need to get out of here. Did anyone see you?"
The chauffeur coughed blood on the carpet and began gesturing and making unintelligible sounds. Emmeline was looking out the window at the road.
"I'll be right back,"
Chester said. He went into the living room and pulled up his trouser leg and removed the British commando knife strapped to his calf. A moment later, he came back into the kitchen and rinsed it in the sink and wiped it with a dish towel. Emmeline stared at him.
"What did you just do?"
"Not much. Asked him why he was waiting on my cause. He didn't answer. Now he can't."
Chester opened the refrigerator and removed a carton of orange juice and drank from it. He heard her go into the living room.
"Oh, my God," she said.
He sat down at the breakfast table, a great fatigue draining through his chest and limbs, the fragmented pieces of his life assembling and reassembling before his eyes. He remembered the music of a calliope in Mexico City, the slap of a teacher's hand, a punishment closet that had no light, a mattress pad soaked with urine.
"Snap out of it, Chester," Emmeline said. "You have to leave. I'll call 911 and tell them we had a home invasion. They'll believe me. They think a killer's after Jimmy. Did anyone see you?"
"Maybe," he replied.
"Maybe isn't good enough."
"A little colored girl named Loretta."
"She saw you with the gun?"
"I told her it was an air gun. I told a lie."
"Where does she live?"
"With a family named Vidwin."
Her eyes burned into his face.
"She saw your car?"
"Yes."
"Did you give her your name?"
"Just Smiley. Not my real name."
He looked at a thought inside his mind, a memory, a dark cloud that shouldn't have been there. He blanched with guilt.
"I said I had a friend named Miss Emmeline."
A twisted cough came out of her chest.
"You gave her my name?"
"She asked me, so I told her. I had already told one lie."
"You know what you have to do now, don't you, Chester?"
"No. Not what you're thinking, Em. No."
"Yes, and anyone with her. You shouldn't have done what you did. You've been a bad boy."
He hung his head and put his hands between his legs and clenched them with his thighs. She looked at her watch.
"Take care of it, Chester. Now. Then call me. We'll get through this."
"The little girl and the people in the house?"
"We have to make sacrifices sometimes."
He nodded, then rose from the chair like a man in his sleep. He went into the living room and looked at the chauffeur curled in a ball on the carpet. He watched where he stepped
and heard the first raindrops of the storm striking the windows and the metal roof and the glass doors, saw the rain